It was really very very rapid, but hopefully, I mean, you get a flavor of the things that we have to deal with when we do nuclear astrophysics. And of course, you can always follow them up in relevant textbooks or articles. So, okay. And Sasan, I guess I saw your paper was featured in some news, in a news article. So that was interesting because I did talk to your advisor, well, previous supervisor at some point about it. Some point maybe can be pursued. Good. So nuclear astrophysics. Any questions? Hey, Mike. So I guess now I have to put this on my schedule, but December 12th is the day, it's the final day for the presentations and the articles to be submitted. So just remember that. So we were talking about, I think we, let's see. I wrote this, I guess, very general formula I remember for. So let me just, I guess, pick it up where I left it off. Wrote this very general formula for for resonant interactions. The idea is that if you have nuclear reaction, two nuclear particles, nuclei combine, give you some unstable state, and then give you two other nuclei, then for resonant reactions, the cross section would be something like this. That's close to resonances or general around resonances. There is the cross section given by the de Broglie wavelength, a number of order unity, ratio of decay rates, and our favorite formula, which is the Lorentzian profile, comes from perturbative quantum mechanics. Okay, so you have a peak at the resonances. For cross sections of interactions of particle. So these would be basically excited states of this guy's E star. And these ERs are of order MeV. So, and lambda bar is the de Broglie wavelength. This is order one. And pi lambda bar squared is pi over p squared, which is, if you just plug in the numbers, is 0.7 barns divided by EMEV. And then this is mu inverse, where mu is reduced mass. Mass in nuclear units. So this is, I think we discussed, so this is the maximal cross section that you expect. Barn was 10 to the minus 26, sorry, 24 square centimeter. This is the maximal cross section we expect for nuclear interactions at the resonances, and everywhere away from the resonances would be much less than this, right? So,
explain the minus two or lambda bar
sorry, this is lambda bar squared. Yeah, my twos are really not very good. Yeah, okay. Right, so, and this is the general thing about, and these gammas are the decay rates. So gamma A is the decay rate of Z star to A, gamma B is the decay rate to B, and gamma is the total decay rate for Z star. And as I said, so this is something general you can derive from quantum mechanics, that this form from time-dependent perturbation theory. And this is a maximal cross-section that comes from unitarity. It's of order Dubroy wavelength. Okay, so that's for resonant interactions. But then, as we discussed, at low energy, at the core of a star like our sun, the temperature is much less than this. It's more like 10 keV. So things like this could happen at very center of very massive stars or during supernova explosions. You could have resonant reactions, but non-resonant reaction is something that's more likely because you don't have typically this higher temperature. Remember how many kelvins was this?
A lot,
yeah. 10 to the 10 Kelvin, right? And our sun is like more like 10 to the 7 Kelvin. So there you have non-resonant interactions or reactions. So non-resonant reaction is the idea that basically, except for neutrons if you have free neutrons, they don't have any problem penetrating nuclei because there is no Coulomb repulsion. But all the other nuclei have a positive charge, so they have to overcome a Coulomb barrier. At small separations, you have the nuclear reactions, which is why you have nuclei. So these are strong forces. If you think of this as a potential as a function of R, you have a strong force, which only acts on small scales because it's like it's something like a van der Waals force for molecules because these are color charged, color neutral. Sorry, the nuclei that you see are color neutral. But then you have Coulomb repulsion barrier. And this is of order MeV, as we were discussing, Z1, Z2 times MeV is this how far this barrier is, typically. And Z is the atomic number. So, even for hydrogen, it has of order MeV, so that doesn't work. And what you need then is to tunnel, right? So if you think of it a wave function, then it has to tunnel. There would be a finite tunneling probability. And this is something that this would be like the wave function of proton or A, for example. Or let's see, psi A of R. So this would be the wave function in quantum mechanics as you would know it, right? And this is something that you did estimate for, I think, for one of your assignments, the first assignment. But what you really estimated was the temperature at which the de Broglie wavelengths become comparable to the size of a nucleus. So that then you could have tunneling of order one, basically. So then basically one of these cycles would be enough to carry you through. Even your classically, you couldn't go through. Quantum mechanically, just there's a one. This would decay within one de Broglie wavelength. So within one de Broglie wavelength, you would be able to cross and without too much suppression. So that was what you calculated. But that's the way to estimate this. The right way to do it is basically to solve the Schrödinger equation in this potential. And if these are non-relativistic particles, because we're talking about KeV temperatures, or even MeV temperature, even if you want to go up to MeV, the mass of a proton is what? GeV. So you're still a long way to go to for these particles become relativistic. So you can just use ordinary quantum mechanics to do this calculation. And the way that you do it, and this is something that I think I talk about very briefly at the beginning of the semester, it's called Euclidean action. Action. Does anybody remember what Euclidean action is?
from the Hamiltonian quantum mechanics, classical quantum mechanics, get like a Lagrangian.
Okay, so you can, that's how you get an action. So what is a Euclidean action?
You recrotate C.
You recrotate
so
C.
C goes to eta.
To eta, right. So and so, what is the significance of this if you do that?
The first knowing of
thermal space or something.
Thermal action.
Well, that's one reason. But I'm here. We're not talking about thermalizing it. Here we're talking about tunneling. So. So the idea is that if you remember quantum mechanics, of course, the way you learn it as an undergrad is solving Schrodinger equation. But another way to do it is from the Feynman path integral. And what you do there is you just sum over all possible trajectories or integrate over all possible trajectories with this phase factor. Right. And this is equivalent to solving Schrodinger equation. It turns out that, so classical physics is when you extremize this S, so that gives you classical equations, but then for the tunneling processes, there is no classical equation, we know that. But it turns out that you can find classical solutions even for some tunneling processes if you let T be a complex number. So that's exactly what Shiamaka described. If you do this analytic continuation, then you could talk about basically integral dx of tau e to the, so it turns out that this action has integral dt in it. And if you replace t by I tau, then that cancels this I, you get minus effective action of this x of tau. And what this does is if you have a Lagrangian, which is, for example, it would be something like this, x dot s squared over 2 minus v of x. And you do this, then you get an Euclidean Lagrangian, which is, so let's see. I mean, I have this multiplied dt to get the action. If I now, this would be equal to, if I do this thing, I would get I, or let me just put an I here in front. That would be the thing that's up here. So this would be equivalent to, if I just replace dt by I d tau, I get minus d tau here, right? And then I just replace this guy. It gets minus x dx by d tau squared over 2. Minus v of x. So I'm not sure whether I have all the right minus signs, but well, do I? Just for the sake of argument, I put this minus I here. So I get plus here. And so what this is basically it's like an action. It's like another Lagrangian. Let's see, here is d tau, here was times dt times I. Here is just times d tau. And I guess there is, right. Except that now the potential is reversed, right? So I have a minus sign here, I have dx by d tau squared over 2 plus v of x. So in terms of this Euclidean time, now I have my potential as opposite sign. So whatever was a barrier for me is now just the opposite of a barrier. So I can go through it without any problem. And basically, so just the classical solution in terms of this Euclidean time is a solution, is what extremizes this Euclidean action. And basically, this would be approximately e to the minus se of x classical. So then basically the idea is that instead of doing this integral in terms of real time, you can do it in terms of imaginary time. And the wave function you get in the classical limit is just e to the minus se of x classical. So this is the up to some prefactors that are order of one, are not that big. But this is basically the idea, is that the tunneling rate goes as e to the minus Euclidean action. And the way you calculate it is just you switch the sign of the potential, find a classical trajectory that connects from here to here, right? And then find the action for that. And this is basically the same. I mean, you can just plug in the number. And this is basically what you see from ordinary quantum mechanics. This is exactly the same thing. It's a tunneling rate. Is proportional to e to the minus integral of k dx, where k is the wave number, or e to the minus integral of 2m, what is it? I guess this v of x minus e times dx. So this is something that should look familiar from ordinary quantum mechanics, because this is just e to the ikx, but then when k becomes imaginary, wave number becomes imaginary, then basically you get the Euclidean wave number, which is I times the regular wave number. And so here, instead of e minus v that you have in ordinary momentum, you have v minus e. So this is real when energy is less than potential. So where the real momentum is imaginary, you cannot have a real particle, you could have this imaginary guy. So anyway, so this is the idea. These two are the same, basically. This is Euclidean action. And this is how you can calculate. This is basically the quick way of calculating tunneling rate if you don't want to solve Schrodinger equation. So it's basically just as easy as solving the classical equation, except that you do it with the opposite sign potential. There you go. Where you go? OK, good. So if you do this, then what you find is the cross section becomes something of order some a slowly varying function of energy divided by energy times e to the minus Euclidean action, which also depends on energy. It's a bit, this E is different from this. This E is energy. This is Euclidean. I don't know. Euclidean. And these parts, you can solve it by solving Schrodinger equation, but you wouldn't get it from this argument, because basically those are the prefactor that sits in front of this exponential. So you have to basically get whatever these things are from actual Schrodinger equation. There is no classical way of getting it.
Why did they call it Euclidean?
Because there's no I in it. I guess it has to do with Lorentzian versus Euclidean. And in Lorentzian space, I guess this is based on, not 100%. So, I think I can tell you. So, usually, in Minkowski metric, it looks like this. Minkowski metric is like eta mu nu is like minus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1. So this thing, this t going to I tau, is like basically making this minus 1 plus 1. Right? It's like a coordinate transformation that you can think of it as changing the time, but you can just think of it also as changing the metric.
Okay.
And because, these two are equivalent to each other, right? You could change the coordinate is like changing a metric. And then, of course, there would be a Euclidean metric, because all of these are plus 1. So that's why it's called Euclidean action. OK. Good. And this you can calculate. And the thing is that, so these guys, you have to do a multi-phase calculation, but they don't matter as much. This exponential is much more important thing. You could take this from order of magnitude. But most of the dependence comes from the exponential, because that varies faster, usually. So if you just do this exercise with the Coulomb potential, then you get something that looks like the Euclidean action. is 2 pi times z alpha zx, or za zx, alpha e divided by v. So do we see where this comes from? So this should be just basically an action of a particle in inverse of this potential. So where it comes from is basically you have a potential which is v is of order z squared e squared divided by r. And so basically you're talking about a trajectory with some velocity. Let's see. Oh, this is the potential, sorry. This is the potential, this is the velocity. So what you want is to calculate momentum times the distance and then express it in terms of momentum. So clear action is of order like momentum times distance. And this is m times v times distance. And then to get the distance, you have to basically equate these guys, mv squared over 2. So does this give the right dependence or not? Let's see. So if I put, I want to substitute for r, so I get m, v, and r is z squared, e squared, over, there's a 2 z squared, e squared, over mv squared. Mv squared, right, good. So the m's cancel. There is only one v left in the denominator, and the rest are. So that's basically how you get it. I mean, this is order of magnitude, but you can, I mean, this is something you can actually calculate. These are analytic integrals that you could do. Because, I mean, the classical trajectory in a 1 over r potential is an integrable problem, right? 1 over r potential is just, what is 1 over r potential? It's just the gravity of the sun. What is that? The Keplerian potential. So those are an integrable, basically, they have integrable forms. Okay, so I mean, in fact, this guy is the action variable, right? Euclidean, this integral with the opposite potential is the action variable, the radial action variable that you have to calculate for one of your problems. Right. Okay, so this is where the form comes from, and what you notice is that for a smaller velocity it's bigger. And since the time inverse that goes e to the minus s, that means that it's going to be less likely, basically. The slower the particle, the less likely it is for it to tunnel. Okay? Okay. So if you plug this in to get sigma v, because that's what you care about, the average of sigma v is what all the reaction rates would be related to. Because n1, n2 times average of sigma v is the average interaction rate per unit volume. You have to basically sum or average over all velocities in a thermal distribution. So this is the Boltzmann or the Maxwell distribution. You multiply by e to the minus se. And then there is v, which is this v, and then there is a sum over the in the momentum space, which is just v squared dv, there's px squared dp or v squared dv, and they are proportional to each other, and so this is what you have to do, and there is also a normalization that you can do it, you can figure out for yourself easily. So the point here is, and there was this 1 over e here that was sitting here as well, you want to keep everything, track of everything. And then there was this S of E I had up here. But the important thing is that these guys depend exponentially. These are just power laws. So the way you can do this this integral is via, how would you do it? What is it called? This exponentials vary much more quickly than the prefactors, has a good name. It starts with this. saddle point, good, it's called saddle point approximation. And basically what you do is that you look for where this is. So in this case, it's actually quite clear because where this thing is big, I mean, it's exponentially big, and where this, sorry, when this is big because of the minus signs, I guess, you think about it, it's e to the minus something. If this thing is big, then the whole integral is exponentially small. So you want to find where this is minimum, basically, right? And you want to expand around the minimum, it's a Gaussian integral around that. So that's basically where it's done. And I mean, this is to some extent how most of physics is done, is an expansion around Gaussian integrals. So if you do that, then you see that this goes as 1 over v. This goes as v squared. So you can find the place that this thing is minimized. You can just take the derivative with respect to v, find where that's minimized, and do this integral. That's the way to do it. And you get something that's don't have the details, and I'm not giving you all the ingredients. For example, you need to know what S is. Well, I guess I am giving you, I can give you in terms of S. So it becomes S. I have A squared, and I'm not sure what this S is. This A is, let me write it down. Mu Z alpha, or Z A, sorry. X times 10 to the minus 18 centimeter cubed per second times T divided by 10 to the 6 Kelvin power minus, let me write it this way. T 6 to the power of minus 2. Two-thirds e to the minus a divided by t6 to the power of one-third. And so in this expression, so this is basically just this integral using saddle point approximation. Saddle point. So mu was just a reduced mass. It's some number of order one. This is reduced mass in atomic units. So some number that's order one. It doesn't have units of grams. It's just it's unitless. Yes?
Is that
Tf? This is T6. So let me, T6 is just T divided by 10 to the 6 Kelvin, right? And A is just a number that comes out of integration ZA, ZX. I guess these are squared. And then this is mu to the power of one third. So this structure, you could already see where it comes from. It's just, let's see, what am I missing here? Is 2 to the 1 half. Okay, good. So this is structure, this prefactors is just, so these are all depend on the velocity. So the thing is that the velocity that maximizes this exponent, that's something that goes as t to the 1 third. And you can see that because basically where these two, this goes as 1 over v, this goes as v squared. And when these two terms become comparable to each other, then that says v cubed is proportional to t. V would be like t to the 1 third. And s Euclidean is just 1 over v, so it's 1 over t to the 1 third. So I mean, this is just simple algebra. You could just plug this in and figure that out. So this is how fast things happen at the center of the sun. How fast fusion happens at the center of the sun. And you could compare this to this cross section that we had here, which I guess this was 10 to the minus 24, right? barn was 10 to the minus 24, right? So a square centimeter. This must be less than that. So is it less than that? Yeah, so this is a bit harder because it depends on the thermal velocity that you put in. So let's say if I want to calculate just sigma, let's just do sigma. So velocity is something like a square root of kT divided by m of protons, let's say. So it's T6. So T6 and 10 to the 6 Kelvin is how many electron volts? Hundred, good. 100 electron volt. Mass of proton is a GeV. So this is 10 to the minus 7 over 2 minus 3 and a half T6 to the 1/2. This is in times the speed of light, right? Times the speed of light, right? And a speed of light is, how big is the speed of light? 3 times 10 to the 10. And then there's minus 3 1/2 T6 to the 1/2 centimeters per second. So this is 10 to the 7 roughly. Right? Okay. So sigma V divided by V. From non-resonant reactions, this is something of order 10 to the minus 18 divided by 10 to the 7, which is 10 to the minus 25. And then times those three factors. OK, so then there's t to the 6, t to the minus, I guess 5/6, and then e to the minus a divided by t6 to the power of 1/3. So, and this is a square centimeter. Okay, so this doesn't look terribly smaller except for that this exponential thing kind of kills things off quite rapidly. I'm not 100% sure whether I've done everything correctly, but I think I don't see any obvious mistake. So it's a little bit bigger. 10 to minus 25. Do you guys see any mistake here? Yes? No? Maybe?
I just have a question. How do you know that like Kelvin goes to EV as 100 EV?
Well, we should have all known that, right? So
1 Kelvin is
1 Kelvin is 10 to the minus 4 electron volts. Right.
1 electron volt is 10 to the minus
4. Okay. 2 bar, yes. One is the reverse of the other one. Okay. So that just comes from, right, I mean, where does it come from? It just comes from converting electron volt unit to Ericsson, you can just figure that out. Right, okay, so the thing is that, I mean, A is 42, right? So this thing actually is, there's an e to the minus 42 also that appears there. So this thing is significantly smaller than the resonant cross section, even if at 10 to the 6 Kelvin. I guess at 10 to the 7 Kelvin, it can be 10 to the 7 Kelvin. There's still a large. The A thing is a big thing. A is 42. So we have 10 to the power of 1/3, which is like 2, and you have e to the minus 42 divided by 2, which is still 21. So e to the minus 21 is what? It's 10 to the 7, 8, or something like that. So the point is that this is much smaller than the resonant cross section, which is, and this was just the de Broglie wavelength. De Broglie wavelength squared. De Broglie wavelength. Okay. And the other significant thing about this is this is a very steep function of temperature, and it's mainly because of this guy. Around 10 to the 6 Kelvin. 42. Around 10 to the 6 Kelvin. You can calculate d sigma, well, we could roughly basically calculate the dependence of this sigma v goes approximately as t to the 14th power. And at lower temperature, it's even a steeper function. So this is basically the way that sun, it's I guess if you've heard about this, there's a solar thermostat. So the temperature at the center of the stars is fixed to a number. It doesn't change very much because it doesn't matter which star you look at. And the reason is that if you increase it a little bit, this cross section increases quite a bit, and then the star expands, cools down until the temperature goes back to basically the fixed amount. So whatever you do, basically what you have to balance this energy generation rate against the energy loss, right? But the thing is that since energy loss doesn't depend so steeply on temperature, the temperature is always fixed basically to some, doesn't vary very much at the center of the star. Right, I mean, we remember we calculated the energy loss rate, right? So the energy loss rate was E dot loss was basically at to the fourth times the volume of a star divided by time for escape, right? Something like this. So it doesn't. This has a small power of temperature, but then the energy generation rate would be this t to the fourteenth times basically the core volume times the density. So the point is basically temperature doesn't vary very much because of this large power at the center of the stars. Good. So that's what's relevant for right. So that's what's relevant for low mass stars like our sun. If you go to high enough temperatures or in supernova, then you get you deal with the resonance interactions, and there. So sigma v for resonance. Then you do the same integral. So the point is sigma v, if you just do this integral or just, well, not sigma v, just, well, let's see. Right, so this would be, remember we had this formula here for sigma. So this would go as v times, let's see. So if I just take that sigma and then average over energies or velocities, what do I do here? Sigma of E dE, then I'm just integrating this guy around the resonance. And I get something that looks like I had the gamma over 2 squared that I have in numerator. And let's see, do I have the right dimensions here? So this becomes, let's see, it's gamma squared integral dE. Divide by e minus er squared time plus gamma over 2 squared. And this integral, you could do it analytically. It's just 2 pi over gamma. Does this have the right dimensions?
Isn't the integral sigma e
yep.
weighted by the probability distribution?
Yeah, that you should do the weighting, right? But there is a weighting that, but I'm just, the point is that this is a very sharp peak. So everything else is, doesn't vary very much. So it's like a delta function. And this is the normalization of the delta function. So that's the idea. So you can, so in this approximation that basically this is a very sharp peak, you can actually do this over, integrate over all the probability distribution, which is indeed what you suggested. And you get something that looks like this, basically. Gamma A, gamma B, divided by gamma. These are all the three factors that we had there. And there is e to the minus e resonance divided by t. So let's see. Do we have all the right factors? Sounds a little bit puzzling that. Okay, so I think this is without the gamma. If I just, I mean, I'm just using this fact, let's say. Just using this that if this is a very sharp peak, that's the integral is just 2 pi over gamma. So then doing the integral, I get a 2 pi over gamma. There is gamma squared, 2 gamma in the denominator. These cancel, so I just get 1 gamma in the denominator. There's g gamma e gamma b, which is the same things that are happening here, these guys. And then there is the Dubroy wavelength, which is a square of that, which is this guy. At the resonance, right? So what I'm, well, let's see. No. What's happening to the Dubroy wavelength? Dubroy wavelength is missing, it seems. Isn't it? There was a 1 over energy there. I think somehow the 1 over energy went into the normalization and disappeared. So assume that this is correct. I haven't screwed this up. So you plug in the numbers. You get something like 10 to the minus 13 centimeter cubed per second times e to the minus er divided by t. And this is for, let's see, this is for 10 to the, for T of order 10 to the 9 Kelvin, which is the temperature. I mean, at much lower temperature, you don't have a resonance. This is 0.1 mega electron volt. So if you compare these numbers, you see that, of course, as we anticipated, and we kind of saw here as well, sigma b there is 10 to the minus 18, here is 10 to the minus 13. So if you can actually go up to these large temperatures, then resonant interactions are much more efficient than the non-resonant ones. OK? Questions? So there is this issue of Debye shielding. I guess I could have mentioned it here. There's the Debye length. Could basically help non-resonant reactions. So remember then, remember this Debye length, but what it does is that it exponentially suppresses the Coulomb potential for charged particles. So if you have to overcome this Coulomb potential, but then if you have a large enough temperature, what happens is, or let's say if you have a small enough temperature, what happens is that this thing is exponentially suppressed at some point. So you don't have to overcome as much of a potential. But that depends on the density of the medium. So it depends on density and temperature. So that at low temperatures, the bio length is small. So of course, the problem at the low temperature is that, I mean, you have to fight this exponential. But then, I mean, this, if the debye length becomes important, then there is another term that appears, which is more complicated because it's an exponential inside the exponential, right? Because the potential is cut off exponentially. So this needs to be done more carefully. But something to have in mind. So the last thing I'm going to do, well, I just want to mention a couple of things that you could do with nuclear reactions, and then just move on to high energy astrophysics. Any questions so far? So let's see what we've derived. So we have the basic formula for resonant reactions in quantum mechanics, but in particular, we have the right numbers for nuclear physics. For nuclear physics, the energies would be of order MeV for resonant reactions. And for non-resonant reactions, energies would be of order KeV, like 10 to the 6 Kelvin is 100 electron volt, which is 0.1 KeV. And basically, you could use these to calculate the energy production rate at the center of stars like our sun, or much bigger stars in principle or supernova, if they can get this as hot as an MeV. So those are the basics for production of energy in reaction rates in nuclear processes that occur in astrophysics. There is one more thing that we can estimate based on things that we've learned, and that's the decay rate. That's also very similar to what we did with atomic physics, but now we just, a lot of the things that we've done here could have been just as well applied to atomic physics. And we just, the scales would be different. Instead of MeV electron MeV scales, we would be talking about electron volt scales, basically. But I mean, this formula, more or less the same for atomic physics. And one example that we've done for atomic physics before, and we can repeat it for nuclear physics, is the decay rate, this gamma, how big the gammas are. That's also important because they come in here, right? The decay rate. All right, so I guess one thing, did I say something? Yeah, right, so the decay rate. And we've used this before, but we had this magical friend that we use all the time. We haven't revisited with him or her in a long time. What was the magic formula? Anybody remember the magic formula? There's a C cubed, there's an A squared, and then what else? So power equals to, what is missing?
2/3.
Okay, 2/3, good.
There's
a Q squared. There's a Q squared, right. There's E squared or Q squared, right, good. So this is the magic formula. And this, you can use this to calculate the decay rate through dipole radiation. So, right, so if you have, so the question would be if you have an excited state of a nucleus, and if how long it takes for it to decay to ground state, and if it happens through emitting photons, then as long as it's not forbidden, it would happen through dipole radiation. And it could be either magnetic or electric dipole radiation. Electric or magnetic dipole radiation. So the way to calculate it is you have to, so this is the way for a single charge particle, but if you can write it in terms of the dipole, so So the way you do it for dipole radiation, I mean the 2/3, let's not write it here, order almost 1, Q times, so this would be Q squared, some length squared, and times frequency to the 4th divided by C cubed, right? And this would be the dipole, the amplitude of dipole, because Q times L is dipole, times omega to the 4th divided by C cubed. So this is the rate of energy loss per dipole if it has frequency omega. So the decay rate is basically how long it takes to emit one photon. The decay happens through emitting one photon. So this will be the decay rate times h bar omega. If you're emitting energy at this power, this is your power. This is the total energy that you want to emit. I think this is gamma inverse, right? Or h bar omega. No, right, right. So h bar omega, this is the energy divided by time, would be energy rate. So gamma would be basically the rate at which you're emitting photons. This is energy divided, energy emitted per unit time. If you divide by energy of each photon, you get the photon that you emit per unit time, and that's the decay rate. So you can then plug in numbers. So gamma h bar is 1, of course. So gamma is d cubed, omega cubed, divided by h bar. Well, I guess somehow I kept h bar. Okay, let's keep it. And then this would be, this D would be the charge, or Q or E, let's say, times the typical size. I mean, I can call it L. I guess I had to call it L here. Squared omega cubed divided by h bar c cubed. So E squared divided by h bar c is alpha, the final structure constant. Omega over c squared is k, the wave number. So I have k times r naught squared, and then I have an additional omega left here. So this is gamma in terms of omega. It's a small by factor of alpha, and it's a small by this factor. This factor is also small because r naught is a typical size of a nucleus. What is the typical size of a nucleus? Angstrom, and in electrovolts units, electron volts units, that's a, what is the Compton wavelength of a proton? What is the mass of a proton? You know that. In electron volts is, wait, you just told me earlier.
1 GeV.
1 GeV. Yes. Okay, so Compton wavelength is just inverse of that, right? So R naught is just GeV inverse. K would be the wave number of the photon that you're emitting. And here, if you're talking about MeV photons, this would be MeV. Right? So this factor is 1,000. It's MeV divided by GeV. And then you have a square. It's 10 to the minus 6. This is like 10 to the minus 8, it turns out, which is... guessing it's correct. Right, so this is of order 10 to the minus 8 times omega for MeV photons. So, or you could write it more explicitly, this goes as E cubed, because it's k squared, well, this is omega cubed. So if you can just plug in here and you get something like 10 to the minus 8 MeV E cubed MeV units. Yes, yeah. So the significance of this 10 to the minus 8 is either here or there, is that it's basically much less than omega, so it's a very narrow resonance. But it's not very narrow by atomic physics standards necessarily, but it's much less than omega. So that means that its resonance is relatively narrow.
Is omega the frequency of the
The photon, right. Which is an S bar omega would be then the energy of the transition.
So
the same as
the
atom.
The wave number of the photon?
K is the wave number. Right. So this formula is true for any emission processes that's dipole. It doesn't have anything to do, doesn't have anything to do with that. So basically it says that gamma divided by omega is suppressed by 1 power of alpha, which is 100. And then the longer the wavelength compared to the size of the object, the smaller this is. Because this is 1 over wavelength, this is the size of the object. So if something is very big, then, if something is very small compared to the wavelength, then it's gonna take a long time for it to decay, basically. And that's what happens for atoms, for example. Atoms, the size of an atom is an angstrom. Oh, by the way, the size of the nucleus is not an angstrom. Right, it's 10^-5 angstrom.
Okay.
Right? Yeah. So the size of an atom is an angstrom. The wavelength of, say, photons, optical photon is 5,000 angstrom, let's say. So that's why this is a small for an atomic emission, and so is this. Okay. Good. See what else? So there's some stuff about weak interactions. So I guess there are just some phenomenological stuff that I probably should mention. Let me just hook up my computer. It's probably that's easier than just me keep talking about it. Could you do? Perfect, thank you. This is perfect. Okay. So we have to wait 16 seconds. So I guess the only thing I was going to say, the next thing I was going to say is just the important processes. So, I mean, everything that we said here were very generic for generic nuclear processes. So I just wanted to mention a few specific nuclear processes that are very important. But this is not, not in a quantitative way. Okay, so come on. Okay, show up. Nothing is happening. Let me just try this again. I think it's connected to the wrong. Oh, that's the reason. Okay. Who would do that? Well, at least I think that was the reason. Okay, let's try again. So that's connected. This is connected. Connected to something. So is there something else maybe I should connect to? So, seem to be having a technical. There you go. Perfect. Just have to wait. Thank you. So, let's see whether I can make this reasonable size. Okay. So, these are the reaction rates I was just telling you about. Right, I was just estimating it's 10 to the 13. I mean, if you compare it to second, it's 10 to the 13 hertz, 10 to the 13 per second. So it happens very fast, but of course, it's a small one, but the decay rate is a small compared to MeV. So in terms of nuclear reactions, the ones that are very important, so I just wanted to mention a few ones. That the nuclear reactions, So there are the so-called the weak reactions, the ones that happen through the weak interaction, and they basically happen. They typically look like this. They you can convert electron. So they happen through exchange of W plus, W minus, and Z bosons, and this is how a typical interaction, this is called beta decay, looks like, where you have a neutron that emits a W plus particle and gives you, well, so gives you a proton, an electron, well, it says positron here, but there is the reverse of that is an electron and an antineutrino. You could also imagine a neutron and a positron combining and giving a proton plus an antineutrino. So these are all possibilities, both of these. Both of these reactions can be, I mean, thought in terms of this diagram. These particles, these are the ones that are predicted by Grasho and Salam and Weinberg. I'm not quite sure exactly.
Yeah,
I'm not sure who first. I guess they did it at the same time. That's why they won the Nobel Prize for it. So these are of order 100 GeV, their masses. That's why they were actually detected, the resonances associated with production of these guys. So what we used to see before discovery of these particles is that we used to see these beta decays. We didn't know what was happening in the middle. And what basically Grasho, Salam, and Weinberg showed is that there is a way to make this theory self-consistent at high energies by adding these particles at the intermediate states. So before that, there was this basically Fermi coupling constant that people used to quantify these reaction rates. And it was something like 10 to the minus 11 per MeV squared. And now we understand it. And then there was a finer structure constant that wasn't a constant for weak reactions. So this is what was like 1 over 137 for nuclear reactions. Sorry, yeah, for electromagnetic reaction, but for weak interactions, for this process, you can define something similar, but it is scaled as energy squared. So it goes as the Fermi constant times energy squared, and in this new picture, it's in fact you could say that GF is some constant divided by mass of W boson squared. And so this is a much better picture because alpha, if it scales like this forever, at some point it becomes bigger than one. So the theory becomes strongly coupled. So it's not a good thing if alpha becomes over there one, if you remember, because in electromagnetism, everything is suppressed by powers of alpha, if you remember. Like here, you have power of alpha that appears here. But then in this new theory, then in fact the coupling constant is G, not alpha, and this G remains small, even at high energies. And as long as energy, the idea is that as long as energy is much less than 100 GeV, which is the case for most interactions that we see in astrophysics, well, at least typical interactions, and cosmic rays you can get much more energetic. You don't produce W's and Z's. What you have is basically, you have effectively this four Fermi interaction. You don't see the W that is produced in the middle. So the time scale you can estimate from this basically the same way that you do this estimate. So I'm guessing, let's see whether it's easy to see that. But I believe you could actually use the same estimate that you had for decay rate, but instead of alpha electromagnetic, you use alpha for weak interactions and find the decay rate. So that somehow works. I'm trying to remember whether that's all that there is to it. Yeah, I don't remember how to derive this. But this is a typical time scale. It's one over GF squared ME to the 5. So let's see, is this This is even a higher power than what we had for, this goes as alpha squared, right? That we had just alpha. So I don't remember how to derive this, but I don't think it was very hard to derive this. So I don't remember exactly how it worked. So this is the time scale that it takes for a neutron to decay to a proton. So if you have a free neutron, you can calculate is how long it's going to stay around, and you find that basically it goes after 1,000 seconds, it's going to decay. So I don't remember the details, but this is how the scaling works. And it takes a long time, much longer than, say, for example, this other time scale that we had. This is 10 to the minus 13 second. This is 10 to the 3 second. And the reason is that this is suppressed by, this is a weak interaction. So it takes much longer for it to take effect. Okay. And finally, this is just a list of other interactions that become important in astrophysics. So the most important one for stars is the PP chain. There are three PP chains, but the most important one is basically this one. So two hydrogens combined make deuterium, positron, and neutrino. Deuterium and helium and hydrogen combined makes helium-3. And then two of these helium-3, so you need two of these guys happening, and then two of these helium-3s can combine, give you helium-4 plus two protons. So the idea is that you basically have four protons coming in, make a helium-4. I guess you have six protons coming in, two coming out, and four of them, and then you have a helium-4 going out. So the number of nucleons doesn't change. So there are two of these guys that are happening. And then the byproduct of two of these guys combined, two helium-3s, give you two protons plus a helium-4. So this is called PP chain, and this is what we think is the most abundant thing that happens at the center of low mass stars, and its role is basically to make helium. If you go to more massive stars, higher temperatures, then there is another cycle that could happen. So it's called CNO cycle, and it's essentially a similar calculation to what we've done, but it happens with carbon. Carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen basically work as catalyzers for this reaction. It doesn't happen for low temperature stars because carbon has larger charge than proton, so the nuclear barrier is higher. So you need higher temperature for this to happen. But at high enough temperature, this is more efficient than this. And notice it actually does the same thing. It takes hydrogens, makes a helium, and at the end you have the same number of CN and O's that you started with. I mean, the C comes in, C goes out. N is produced in the process, right? Okay, there is an N14 that comes in. And an I guess the only thing that you need is carbon. What happens, you get carbon becomes nitrogen, becomes carbon again, carbon becomes nitrogen again, nitrogen becomes oxygen becomes nitrogen, and then again you just end up with the carbon. So this is just, you start with a carbon, you end with a carbon, but in the process what you do is that you take four hydrogen and make one helium. So for sun, this is 10 times less efficient than PP. So you have other processes like white dwarfs. If you run out of hydrogen, then of course none of these work. You can form helium, or you can burn helium. You have a big enough or heavy enough white dwarf if it's not degenerate. And another process that I haven't written here is neutron capture. And this typically happens in supernova, where you have a lot of free neutrons. So basically, a combination of these processes is how you form heavy elements. At low temperatures, you could just have this one. You just make helium. But as you go to higher temperatures, then you can make heavier elements. And this happens through a combination of fusion effects and neutron captures. And you can basically form all elements in principle. So that's all I had to say about nuclear reactions, which is not very deep as you realize, but basically I think it's more of a survey of the important physical processes that appear. Any questions? Nope? Okay, so let's go back to the board for the last 10 minutes.
Well, I have a question about
sure.
So
when did
the other two happen?
Right. So let's see.
Well, the second one is a helium.
Is this right?
It's a sequence, isn't it? It's like you have PP1, which creates helium. PP2, which makes beryllium. PP3, which is another that makes helium 4.
Well, this one takes helium 3 and makes helium 4, right?
Yeah.
Right. And I guess lithium, it's produced and destroyed in the process. Beryllium is produced and destroyed in the process. So I think all this is doing is just changing helium 3 to helium 4. So this is basically another way of completing this process. But here you combine helium 3s and then give you helium 4. Here you have a helium 3 and helium 4 already. It makes you another helium 4. So anyway, so these are suppressed. I actually am not very familiar with these two other processes. But these are, I think, other ways of completing the process, generating more helium. So here, you start with the beryllium. What's happening to the beryllium?
Well, the PP2 seems familiar from like primordial nucleosynthesis, where you have a lot of hydrogen and helium to start with, and then you generate
You always have a lot of hydrogen and helium, but I mean, right. I mean, after, because you primordially generate it. Yeah, I'm not as familiar with these two ones. Yeah, I'm not as familiar. I'm not 100% sure when they become. I know this is the most abundant thing that could happen. Okay. Good. So let's just, let's see. Let me just go to the other slide I have. Maybe it's better to just go with this slide. Okay, so I guess we have one more lecture left. So let me just show you, I mean, these are things I will be saying in words, and I guess I will leave the derivations for the next session. So basically, historically, high energy astrophysics refers to processes that was nuclear physics, and I mean, in some sense, it is a subset of high energy astrophysics. So high energy astrophysics, historically, anything that you have particles or photons that have energies bigger than keV, they're called high energy astrophysics, and they were, regular astronomy was done by telescopes and in astronomy departments, but then high energy astrophysics is done in physics department. So that's one of the differences. And that was...
purely theoretical?
No, it's actually the experimentalists live in physics departments.
Oh, so in laboratories.
Like Ice Cube would be a high energy astrophysicist.
Right, it's just a historical debate. So in the old days, the astronomers are people who used big telescopes. Physicists are things that, work with experiments. And nowadays everything is mixed together, but historically they were different. So there was high energy astrophysics. Like, if you're dealing with X-rays, you're not usually an astronomer, you're in a physics department. So the people who were in astronomy departments were counting as stars, and that's what they were doing. So the people who worked in high-energy astrophysics, everything at the bottom, So at below KV, it would be like extreme ultraviolet, which I guess we didn't use to see until recently. Those, but optical and ultraviolet is the realm of astronomy. This is high energy astrophysics, and it's not just a historical division. It's not real. I mean, it's not a real physical division. And the examples where this become important is like if you have accretion into relativistic compact objects. Remember, we just talked about center of the sun. That's a high energy process, but we don't actually see those high energy photons. They're at the center of the sun, so the things that do get to us are much lower energy. However, you could have similarly high temperatures around when you have accretion into compact objects, like into neutrino stars or black holes. That's one place where you can get very high energies, typically. The X-rays, you can produce X-rays, for example, or even higher energy. Supernova explosions and gamma ray bursts is another example of where you can get very energetic particles. Gamma rays could come out of, gamma ray bursts, I mean, historically, there are different supernovas. You see them in optical gamma ray bursts. You see them in, they were first discovered in gamma rays, but now we think they have a similar origin. I think gamma ray bursts are a particular type of supernovae. These are also much more energetic than a typical star. And then another place where you could generate very high energy particles is if you can convert larger scale kinetic or gravitational energy into random energy. For example, in galaxy clusters, that's what this happens. The typical virial temperature of a galaxy cluster is KeV, so you can actually make X-ray from that. Or corona of a star, stellar corona on wind, they actually have KeV energies. And another one is Fermi acceleration, which is basically how you can convert the global motion, which is non-relativistic in the interstellar medium, into energetic motion of particles. And that we're going to talk about in some detail, probably on Thursday. So I think this is probably a good place to stop because I have to, because people are waiting at the door. but before I get to any derivation, so the next thing I'm going to draw for you Fermi acceleration and basically processes that are relevant to that. And so that's the plan for our last lecture, is to talk about Fermi acceleration and all the other important processes in high energy astrophysics.